assuming that I'm not. We need to redo, reorganize, restructure what we're doing before and as we pour money into this. We will need more money, but it won't be effective if we don't also revise the system. And my program would include early childhood intervention, and as to that third grader that we're talking about, improved curriculum, stopping the over-reliance on standardized testing, improving the career track for teachers, enabling teachers to advance, be promoted, and get paid more without leaving the classroom. All too often, our good teachers have to be moved to another job or into administration to get more pay. We need our great teachers to stay in the classroom. In many parts of the state where there's concentrated poverty, we need community wraparound services that enable the children to come to class ready to learn. We need much better vocational training where we're matching what we're teaching, either in the high schools or community colleges, with the skills that are needed for the jobs of today and tomorrow. All of this is part of the plan and would be what would move us forward and enable us to catch up.
So let's talk about a couple of those things. You mentioned the over-reliance on testing. What metric other than testing would you suggest?
Well, what you need is a variety of metrics that include accomplishing tasks and reaching levels that are measured in ways other than whether you can score a particular score on a test or not. So if you look at the Kerwin Commission, they've delved carefully into the kinds of advancement that we need. We have a tendency just to promote people by chronological age, move ahead. And what we need instead, and what the great systems in the world have, is a much more well-rounded assessment of whether the student is proceeding in the direction you want.
So how do you measure that then? I mean, there's got to be some way of measuring it to say, okay, our kids are now smarter than they were in 2018.
Well, yeah? It certainly would include standardized testing, but it would also include accomplishing tasks, writing essays, being able to finish projects, having a maturing approach to life. And these things can be measured. They're less quantitative, but they're not hard to identify for a good teacher.
You mentioned the Kerwin Commission, and obviously Britt Kerwin is a person with whom you've worked closely on the Board of Regents. They have delayed their recommendations. Some people think that perhaps is, you know, attributable to the political season that we're in. Perhaps they will release their recommendations long-awaited after the primary, perhaps even after the November election. But a consultant that they hired said that really to fix the school funding formulas that we have would cost something like $2.9 billion more dollars than we're currently spending. We're already spending, you know, $7.9 billion on education. So they're talking about going from essentially $8 billion to $10 billion in education funding. Two parts to this. How do you come up with the extra $3 billion? And then what do you spend it on? What makes a difference?
Well, let's answer the second part first, because I've alluded to that already. We need to revise and revamp the system and put in the kinds of programs that are in my plan and are also in the Kerwin Commission draft report, which came out in early January, I think. So this teacher track, principal track that I've got, the vocational programs, the revised method of teaching and evaluating, all that needs to come into play as we put more money in it. And we do obviously face a substantial burden in financing this. I would note that the increase this time, even the one that you proposed of the 8 to 10 billion, is not anywhere near as large a jump as we took when we did the Thornton revision, which was, I think, something like 60% increase.
But so, to fund what Thornton says we should fund is an extra $3 billion.
Right. Right.
I'm so doing the math wrong. It's actually 8 to 11, isn't it? You
know? No. Well, 8 to 11 is fine. But the point is that the jump this time is not anywhere near as significant as the jump we took in early 2000s to do this. But we need political will to do it. We need revenue flows. The casino money has been substituting, and now finally we're going to have it supplement the money. That's a big chunk of money. I think it's around $400 million a year. We have new sources of revenue that are going to come online that we ought to jump on and make sure they're dedicated to the education system. Marijuana is one. The state of Colorado is reaping literally, I think, millions or more, hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenue from regulating the marijuana that's traded.
So you support the legalization of recreational marijuana?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do.
And do you support allocating, you know, by statute, revenue from the oversight of that industry directly just to education?
I'm not sure we'd do it just to education, and I haven't seen the bill that would regulate and tax, so it doesn't even exist today. So I'm simply pointing out it is an available new line of revenue that we should use, if not completely, but in part, for education. We can't have a higher priority than education. And let me just say as an aside, we are the richest state in the richest country in the history of the world. We should be able to educate our children and educate them well. So it is a matter of political will, I think.
Jim Shea is the former chair of the Board of Regents of the University System of Maryland and the former chair of the law firm Venable LLP. He's one of nine Democrats running in the June primary for the chance to face Republican Governor Larry Hogan in the general election in November. We'll have more with Jim Shea after a quick break. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. You can join us there. You can also give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up Monday on our program, Midday senior producer Rob Sivak will be sitting in for me. He's going to talk to the author and youth advocate Kevin Sheard about his new book, The Colored Waiting Room. Plus, Kamau High, he's the managing editor of the Afro newspaper. He's going to join Rob for the Afro check-in. If you're just joining us today, Jim Shea is my guest. He's one of nine candidates running in the June primary to be the Democratic nominee for governor. And by the way, you can hear all of our conversations with the candidates at our website, wypr.org/midday. You are welcome to be part of our conversation with Jim Shea. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Jim Shea, let's go to the phones. Julia in Baltimore is on the line. Julia, welcome to Midday with Jim Shea.
Yes, thank you. My question is, when are legislators going to get smart enough to do away with No Child Left Behind? We're passing these kids, and they're graduating from the 12th grade, and they can barely read at the third grade level.
All right. Thanks for the call, Julie. I appreciate it. So No Child Left Behind, again, a federal initiative that's now some years old. It's been supplanted by a couple of things. That was the Bush era initiative. It was supplanted by Race to the Top within the Obama administration. When you talk about the systematic change of the system, you're not just talking about money. So what kinds of things are you talking about changing?
Well, Julia's right. We do just pass children on from grade to grade and then graduate them. And this, we were talking earlier about assessing the progress, the true progress of the student. And they're not going to progress if you don't teach them well. And that means curriculum. That means early childhood intervention. That means a good teacher track that enables the educators to have the professional standing and compensation that they should have. It means vocational training and all the things that are part of my plan.
The Kerwin Commission is going to make some recommendations, Lord knows when. What should be in that report? What would you like to see the Kerwin Commission say to the legislature? This is what we need to do to fix what's ailing us.
Well, again, it's very much in my plan, and it's along the lines of what we've been talking about. I think we have to recognize that areas of concentrated poverty need additional funding because they need to provide additional sources or services such as community schooling and after-school programs and summer programs and a variety of needs that the children in those communities have so that they come to classroom ready to learn.
How about free community college tuition. There are a number of local jurisdictions that are jumping on that bandwagon, and then there was a bill just passed Monday night in the General Assembly.
Right. I called for in my education plan free community college for everyone who is at or below 150% of the median income. The point was to make sure that low and middle income people could get a community college education. And that's essentially what this General Assembly did. It devoted a certain amount of money. I can't remember. I think it might have been $15 million for what amounts to scholarships.
Scholarships.
For low and low and middle income students. So essentially the same thing. We need people to be well-trained and ready for the workforce and have the skills that the jobs of today require. All of us need that. It's not just the students that need it. We need them. If you try to get a plumber lately, or electrician, or an auto mechanic, we need to be sure we're turning out the kinds of students with the skills that are needed. And the community colleges are a great place to do that.
So what is the capacity of the governor's office, and your capacity in particular, to turn those kinds of policy initiatives into statutes, into budget priorities? Obviously, everybody always says, budgets are a reflection of one's priorities. But when you talk about the things that you want to do in education, universal pre-K, updating the curriculum, paying teachers more, community schools, and assisting, low poverty or low income areas in special ways. Folks would say, well, those are all great things. They're wonderful things. And if we could have afforded them, we would have done them. What's different?
Well, we could have afforded them, and we didn't do them. I have the ability to bring lots of different groups together. In the education area, I have a long, deep history with the business community. I have a long, deep history in the educational community. I'm going to challenge both of those groups to advance us, to make sure that we're matching what we're teaching with the skills that are needed. And both groups need to be challenged and pushed, and I'll be able to do that. Able to do that in a variety of other areas as well, bridging gaps in healthcare, bridging gaps in environmental problems. But I'm able to assemble. I've worked a long time in this community, in this state, and I'm familiar with most of the major groups, having worked with them or represented them in the education area particularly.
We have a question from a listener about transportation. That's another issue that you've been involved in your civic work. How's Mr. Shea going to get counties to coalesce around investing in transit that equitably connects Marylanders to opportunities? For example, 9 counties in Maryland have MARC lines, but there is little vision to grow business and housing around them. That comes in on Twitter.
It's a great question. My transportation plan focuses a lot on MARC. MARC is a system that is good, but it could be so much better. We need more trains. They need to move faster, and we need them to be operationally effective and not breaking down as often as they do. But we do have 3 great lines that the MARC provides. It's the Penn Line between Baltimore and Washington, the Camden Line, which runs between Baltimore and College Park, and the Brunswick Line that runs out to Western Maryland, and with some extension could really bring in a lot of Western Maryland into the greater Washington area. So my plan talks about linking all of that. But here's a really important point. Right now, we have no plan. There's no plan out there that people can look at from wherever they are, Salisbury, Western Maryland, Montgomery County, Baltimore. There's no plan. The first thing I would do as governor is take the plan that I've got and vet it all around the state, probably end up amending it to some extent because people have good ideas everywhere. But we need a statewide plan that people can see and to some extent buy into, so that when there's an improvement in one part of the state, the people in the other part of the state recognize that it's a whole, that it benefits everybody, and that they'll have the improvements in their area when the time comes. Without the plan, we're doing transportation projects here and there and everywhere. Roads to nowhere, or as I like to say, roads halfway to nowhere, are our specialty these days because we don't have a plan.
You, along with many of your compatriots on the Democratic ballot in June in the gubernatorial race, have condemned Governor Hogan's decision to cancel the red line, and you've all said that you want to resurrect it. How does that happen?
Well,
because in canceling the red line, Mr. Hogan also walked away from $900+ million of federal subsidies.
Forfeited it. I mean, it's gone. And you're right. Resurrecting the red line is difficult at this point. You have to get back at the end of the queue that we started at years ago. It was a crippling, crippling decision. Senator Mikulski asked the Hogan administration to not just cancel it, but seek to amend it so we could stay in the queue. No. Answer was no. We're out. And we are out. So we have to go back to the end of the queue. And by the way, with President Trump in office, there is no queue right now. Nothing's moving anywhere. So we need to go ahead and get back in the queue once the queue exists again. But we can't wait until the red line is truly resurrected. We need to do a lot of interim work, bus rapid transit, extension of the metro we do have. We need to connect up our metro infrastructure soon and not after we've gone through the federal process again.
You note on your website, if I understand it correctly, that people in Maryland, Marylanders, take about 430,000 trips on the Washington Metro every day. So you would be in favor of state funds going to help shore up and fix and maintain infrastructure of the Washington Metro system?
Yes, and we did that. The General Assembly did that this session, dedicating a large amount of money for the Metro. Look, the Metro does help us all. And let me repeat that one of my strategic goals for the state is to utilize one of our greatest assets, which is its proximity to Washington, D.C., and to utilize it very effectively. We need to connect to the Metro, and we need the Metro to work to get us in and around Washington.
Jim Shea is my guest. He is one of nine Democrats running for the office of governor in the Democratic primary in June. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And to find us on Twitter, @MiddayWYPR. We are also streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to go to Facebook, Jim Shea. Rebecca writes in, Mr. Shea says that he supports the legalization of marijuana, but what is his opinion on current drug convictions and how they should be handled in the event of that kind of legislation?
Well, I don't know whether the question is focused on marijuana or other drugs, but let me just deal quickly with
both. We have an incarceration epidemic, and
yes,
an awful lot of people in prison because of their
use of drugs.
People found sometimes very small amounts of marijuana.
Yeah.
What happens to those sentences if it's legalized?
Well, I think we ought to look at expunging the records of those who have been convicted of possession of marijuana. Right now, we have the police in limbo, not knowing whether to really strictly enforce the laws of possession of marijuana and not. We have people killing each other in the streets of Baltimore over trades of marijuana. If we regulate it, all of that will end. And we should regulate it and do it sensibly, as I mentioned before. And as to other drugs, while I'm not calling for allowing them to be used, I think we've got to recognize that a drug addiction is not a criminal justice problem. It's a health problem. It's a medical problem. And we have programs that should be expanded that divert the drug offender, as opposed to the violent offender. The drug offender needs to be diverted into treatment and not into jail. We're on a revolving wheel of sending people to jail, doing nothing for them, have them come out without a job, but with a big scar on their record and no hope of being able to participate effectively in society. We need to change that.
Let me ask you to clarify something. You said that the police are kind of in limbo about marijuana laws. I mean, I think there are some folks in East and West Baltimore who say there's no limbo about it. They're getting arrested for small amounts of marijuana, and they are being prosecuted and incarcerated.
Well, I'm listening to my running mate, Brandon Scott, who knows the public safety issues in Baltimore like nobody I've ever met. And he's made the point it is difficult for the police. They're trying to focus on the violent offenders and making sure they're getting the really bad people off the street. And when you stop to arrest people for the possession of a small amount of marijuana, you're really not enhancing public safety.
When it comes to public safety and violence reduction, there was big controversy about a bill that Senator Bobby Zirkin, a Democrat from Baltimore County, sponsored and had the full support of Republican Governor Hogan. The Senate Bill 122, as they called it, the Omnibus Crime Bill, and it had a number of different parts to it. It ended up not passing in its in that form. It was sort of chopped up a little bit, and there were parts of it that that did pass, including funding for Safe Streets, which is an intervention program. But the push of much of that omnibus crime bill was sentencing, mandatory minimum sentences, and what the governor likes to call truth in sentencing, meaning if you're sentenced to 10 years in jail, you shouldn't get out after 4 years on probation. What's your feeling about that particular approach to violence reduction?
Well, I'm against mandatory minimums. All our history has shown that they're not effective. And what we need, in Baltimore in particular, but throughout the state, when we're fighting violent crime, and we've got an epidemic of violent crime here in the city, we need all of the participants in the system to be operating at an optimal level. And by that I mean the police, the prosecutors, the judges, the correctional facilities, all need to be operating at their very best. And what's happening with this mandatory minimum, the impetus of it is the blame game. And Governor Hogan plays this on almost every issue. It's not my fault. It's the judge's fault in this particular case. The judges just aren't being tough enough. Let's reduce their discretion. That's a bad idea. If you want each of the parts of the system to operate at the optimal level, you give them the tools and the freedom to do that. Sure, you advocate for changes and you monitor for changes, but if you're going to be a true leader, and we need leadership on this issue, you're going to bring all the parts of the system together and give them the ability to solve the problem. And telling judges they don't have the discretion to give less than X years is a bad idea. Judges are supposed to judge.
Given what just happened in the General Assembly this year, the range of issues, gun regulation, the banning of bump stocks, for example, the change to the permitting process for handguns. I mean, were there things that you wished had happened in this session that did not? And were you to be elected in 2019, what would be your priorities for the session?
Well, my priorities would be education, but we're talking about guns right now. I mean, there's a lot more that can be done. We have good gun safety legislation in Maryland, but it can be improved. There's still loopholes for assault rifles. The possession of a handgun is a misdemeanor, not a felony. And there, by the way, is something that gives the judges a tool to really crack down on the violent offender. Somebody who's possessing a handgun now has a felony and enables the judge to give a much greater sentence. That's what we should be doing, is instead of reducing their discretion, increasing their arsenal of tools to use. But there are a lot of gun safety measures that we could do.
We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion and take phone calls and emails and tweets from our listeners. Jim Shea is my guest this afternoon. He's one of nine candidates running in the June primary to be the Democratic nominee for governor. His running mate is Baltimore City Councilman Brandon Scott, who represents the 2nd District and who chairs the Public Safety Committee on the Baltimore City Council. More with Jim Shea when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. And if you've just joined us, it's the latest in our series of Conversations with the Candidates. My guest is Jim Shea. He's the former chair of the Board of the Regents of the University System of Maryland. He's also the former chair of the Empower Baltimore Management Corporation, the Downtown Partnership of Baltimore, and the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance. He's a lawyer and the former chair of Venable LLP. That's Maryland's largest law firm. His opponents in the June primary include Rashern Baker, Kevin Kamenetz, Ben Jealous, Richard Modaleno, Alec Ross, Krish Vignaraja, and two others. If you have a question or a comment for Jim Shea, our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to find us in the Twittersphere at Midday WYPR. And you can check us out on Facebook. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones. Jim Shea, Phil in Baltimore, welcome to the program with Jim Shea.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, Mr. Shea.
Good afternoon.
I am also 65 years old, but I have a pretty good memory. And I know that on January 4th, 1987, in Chase, Maryland, there was a terrible Amtrak train crash which killed 16 people and wounded many more, some college students, and the driver had been smoking marijuana earlier that day. It's made national news on January 4th, 1987. I would suggest to you it's not just such a casual thing. And secondly, Mr. Hogan was elected governor in 2014, 2 years before Donald Trump was elected president in 2016. So I don't know why you're trying to... Mr. Hogan does not agree with Mr. Trump on many issues and has made it very clear. So not all Republicans are exactly alike either, okay?
I understand that.
Thanks for your comment.
Yeah. Well, let me start with the second one first. Larry Hogan has been largely silent about President Trump on many, many issues. And when you're dealing with somebody like Trump, who's a bully, silence is not neutral. It enables the bully to push ahead. We need a governor who will stand up to Trump and fight the battles that Marylanders need fought. With respect to the train derailment, and I remember it well, we've had train operators who have been drunk on alcohol as well. All of that needs to be carefully monitored and stopped. In legalizing marijuana, I in no way condone any usage that would create any kind of public health risk.
Here's a question about economic development and jobs from Annette, who writes in on email. I find Mr. Shea's ideas on pre-K and transportation to be interesting. I wonder what his ideas are to help seniors in their 60s to find jobs. Age discrimination is a big problem. The private sector doesn't help. Some individual companies have good policies, but many employers are afraid to hire overqualified adults in their later years. Many seniors still can and want to work and need opportunities.
I couldn't agree more. And my plan, I'm glad the question was asked, because my plan includes retraining for Maryland citizens, particularly those who lose their job throughout their lives. In today's world, we have innovation that is productive and profitable, but it knocks people out of their jobs and leaves them without any means. The social cost of that needs to be covered by all of us, by the government, for retraining programs available to everyone, because 55 and 60 and 65-year-old people still want to work, and we want them to work. In addition, our seniors built this state. They gave us a great state. We should make sure that we enable them to do what they want, stay, for example, in their homes, if that's what they prefer, but we should also encourage them to use their wisdom and experience to mentor others. And many seniors would like to do that. As governor, I would create and promote programs that enable us to benefit from the wisdom, that accumulated wisdom that seniors have.
A $15 minimum wage has been something that various individual jurisdictions have considered. The legislature considered it this past term and did not pass it. What's your position on that?
I think we should have a $15 minimum wage. The notion that somebody can work full-time and work hard and work well at less than $15 an hour, be paid less than $15 an hour, means they won't be able to feed their family. And I don't think that's right. I think we have to have a starting position that if somebody works full time, they should get paid enough to have a decent life.
When it comes to certain of those kinds of policy proposals, for example, paid family leave, paid sick leave, which was controversial, it was passed by the legislature, the governor vetoed it, and then the legislature overrode that veto as one of their first acts of this 2018 mm-hmm. session. That took 6 years mm-hmm. to pass. Lou Klippinger was on the show just yesterday, and he worked on that for 6 years and finally got a version of it passed. So what can you do? The $15 minimum wage has been talked about now forever. I mean, what can you do to actually convert that policy notion into law?
Well, and not only that, but the bills that have proposed it phase it in over time. So add to the length of time you're talking about. Well, here again, my position and history with the business community puts me in a uniquely capable position to advocate for things like this. I have great sympathy for small businesses. I've worked with small businesses. I've created hundreds of startups. As chair of the USM, while I was chair, we created 451 startups in the 4 years I was chair. In the empowerment zones, we created all kinds of small companies and assisted small companies. I understand the difficulties that they face, but I also understand the benefit that we all get if we have things like the $15 minimum wage. So I can use the bully pulpit of the governor's office better than I think anybody else in the field.
We have an email from Miner who says, Mr. Shea chaired the University of Maryland board when the decision was made to leave the ACC. And join the Big Ten. So regardless of whether people like that decision or not, why was it done in a closed meeting without notice? Will Mr. Shea govern by openness and trusting the people to know of possible decisions or follow the idea of secret closed meetings?
Well, I will certainly have open and transparent government. The Big Ten decision was hampered by the fact that the Big Ten demanded confidentiality of the financial aspects of that. There was no deal if we revealed the financial aspects of the Big Ten transfer, and the Big Ten transfer was very good for Maryland, and it was very good financially. I regret that one meeting was closed improperly, but that will never happen again. It came through a confluence of mistakes that weren't mine, but I take full responsibility for them because I was the chair.
I mean, I think Miner's email brings up a larger issue of distrust and cynicism about government in general. And certainly Mr. Trump is not the first candidate for president to talk about cynicism and talk about a distrust of the government. And then there are an awful lot of people who currently don't trust him as the president in terms of his interesting relationship to verisimilitude. But when it comes to cynicism, which, you know, some people can date back to the Reagan administration, you know, the government is not your friend, it's on your back, we're going to get it off of your back. How do you, particularly as a non-politician, as a person who never held elective office, how do you restore trust in the public sphere and in the political process?
Well, I think we need leaders who are not afraid to be unelected. And I'm not afraid of being unelected. I've got a set of problems that I see Maryland has that need to be solved, and I'm going to set about solving them as best I can. And I'm going to be open and transparent about that, and people are going to have a chance to agree and disagree. I'm going to listen, and we're going to make progress. That's my style. That's what I've always done in leading these organizations, and I will do that as leader of the state.
Speaking of unelecting people, the governor very strongly supports term limits for people in the House and the Senate here in Maryland. How about you?
I haven't taken a position on term limits. I know from my experience of running organizations that when you get a really good leader, to turn them out for an arbitrary reason like a term limit doesn't strike me as very sensible. You don't see any organizations having term limits for their executives. So I wonder, the other problem with term limits is that last term, there's no accountability. The politician no longer is accounting for his actions to the public, and they often go off the rails. I fear, for example, what will happen during Larry Hogan's last 4 years as a term-limited governor.
Dave in Baltimore, let's go to you. Welcome to Midday with Jim Shea.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Two brief questions. Affordable housing in our city, what would you do to help that along? And do you mandate jobs for our inner cities like Baltimore, Detroit, Cleveland, and trade bills like NAFTA? Is that possible? Can you get something like that through our state senators and representatives? Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm not sure I understand the second part of it. I think the trade agreements like NAFTA are federal, and I'm not sure what Maryland could do. We certainly want to open trade.
Well, in terms of business development and incentives to business, obviously we have this big TIF proposal or deal now with a company like Under Armour. Do you support that kind of approach to attracting business?
You know, I think we ought to look much harder at these financial incentives. I'm not saying I would never use one, but when you use one, you ought to do a cost-benefit analysis ahead of time. How much is it going to cost, and how much are we going to get from it? I don't think we're doing that. I don't know of any cost-benefit analysis on the incentives that were given or are being given to Amazon, for example. And then after the fact, we should see whether we did get a good deal or not and understand better. I would not use a financial incentive unless I knew what was going to be the cost and benefit. The problem with these things is that politicians want the big press conference of the big win, the companies coming into town. The bill gets paid years later when somebody else is in office by all of us. So I'm very skeptical about the use of financial incentives.
Did you support the bill to provide these incentives and infrastructure perks to Amazon? I mean, it's by many accounts the largest government subsidy of Amazon that's being offered of the 20 locations they're thinking about.
Right. I haven't done a careful analytical study that would show me, but I am very skeptical of giving the richest man in the world billions of dollars. I just don't think that makes a lot of sense.
But what if the richest man in the world, Mr. Bezos, gives 50,000 jobs to the state of Maryland? That's what folks would counter with.
Right, and how much are we going to get from those 50,000 jobs? How are we going to have an infrastructure that supports the 50,000 jobs? How much benefit will it really be? I didn't see any analysis like that. In the absence of such an analysis, I would be against those kinds of packages.
In terms of the city of Baltimore, we just have a few seconds left here, and restoring trust in the police department. We had this horrible gun trace task force trial. What can the state do to shore up people's confidence in the Baltimore City Police Department?
Well, the Baltimore City Police Department is actually a state agency, a little known fact. It's a quirk of history. The state should certainly be full partners in the consent decree, and they're not, in all the efforts to restore the trust of our citizens in the police department. That would be a very big part of what I would do as governor.
Jim Shea is the former chair of the Board of Regents of the University System of Maryland and the former chair of the law firm Venable LLP. He is one of 9 Democrats running in the June primary for the chance to face Republican incumbent Governor Larry Hogan in the general election in November. We've got a link to Jim Shea's campaign website on our website, wipr.org/midday. Jim Shea, it's good to see you. Thank you for coming in, and we will keep an eye on you as the campaign continues.
Thanks, Tom.
Early voting begins in 63 days on June 14th. The election is June 26th. Make sure that you vote. That's it for us today. Join us on Monday when Midday senior producer Rob Sivak interviews the author and youth advocate Kevin Sheard about his new book that chronicles his conversations and travels with Nelson Mauldin, who knew Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Mr. Mauldin was Dr. King's barber. The book is called The Colored Waiting Room. Rob will also speak with Kamau High, the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper, for our regular feature, The Afro Check-In. We want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels for lunch today. Bottoms Up is a small-batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by the traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. They are available at the Waverly and the JFX Farmers Markets and online at Bottoms Up Bagels. Bagels.com. Midday's director and engineer is the one and only the bold and beautiful Luke Spicknall. Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produce our program. Jamila Krempel is our digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Good luck to everybody from Maryland who's running the Boston Marathon. I'll be there to cheer you on. Have a great weekend.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.